And what was so extraordinary was Julian was his incredibly commanding figure, as you can imagine, and Britten looked rather insignificant behind him conducting the chamber ensemble. And the other thing I remember from it was that the hall was only just two-thirds full, wasn't even full.
So thinking about the poetry then, Alexander, what do you think characterises his choices of poetry?
Britten is a very unusual and eclectic kind of reader, actually, which is partly why he loved to read anthologies. There were so many anthologies in his library. Boris Ford makes a great long list of them. I don't think we really appreciate anthologies these days. We tend to get the complete works of Tennyson. But Britten would go to a collection of madrigals, he would go to a collection of flower poems, and he loved the joy of discovery. He loved finding, for example, the poetry of Crabbe. He loved being able to say, we've just discovered George Crabbe. And each of his findings come with a whole kind of narrative around them, when he first read it, where he was. He loved to juxtapose poems. So he is himself a great anthologist. So in something like the Spring Symphony, he'll give us the medieval spring songs we expect, and then Auden's Out on the Lawn I Lie in Bed, with violent sounds from Poland coming through in the middle, strange contrasts. He'll invoke the pastoral, but then give us the shadowiness underneath it. Peter Porter writes a brilliant essay about him in which he says there's nothing of the half-timbered in Britten's choice of poetry. And I think that's very telling about his suspicion of oldie England. And yet he wants to find a way of being English, but without the half-timber and the real ale.
Well, let's see an example of Britten's eclectic taste with our first reading. It's Christopher Smart's I Will Consider My Cat Geoffrey from Rejoice in the Lamb.
For I will consider my cat Geoffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him. For at the first glance of the glory of God in the east, he worships in his way. For this is done by wreathing his body seven times round with elegant quickness. For he knows that God is his saviour. For God has blessed him in the variety of his movements. For there is nothing sweeter than his peace when at rest. For I am possessed of a cat surpassing in beauty, from whom I take occasion to bless Almighty God. For the mouse is a creature of great personal valor. For this is a true case. Cat takes female mouse will not depart, but stands threatening and daring. If you will let her go, I will engage you as prodigious a creature as you are. For the mouse is a creature of great personal valour, for the mouse is of an hospitable disposition, for the flowers are great blessings, for the flowers have their angels, even the words of God's creation, for the flower glorifies God, and the root parries the adversary, for there is a language of flowers. For flowers are peculiarly the poetry of Christ.
Alexander, that's an odd, quirky poem to start with, but also a strange choice for a poem to celebrate the anniversary of the consecration of a church.
Well, that's it. This is a commission for a good community piece for Northampton Church. And Britten thinks, well, obviously we must do My Cat Geoffrey by this totally unknown poet, Christopher Smart. And Walter Hussey, the vicar of St. Matthew's, who was known for very Catholic tastes, even he was a bit surprised by this choice, a little bit anxious about how it was going to go down. But of course it was a triumph. And it just shows you how Britten finds what's familiar and funny and also sacred in poems which look quite alarming. It was written by Christopher Smart when he was in an asylum, and he worked on it over 4 years and would add to it. It was like a diary almost, and all he had in the world was his room and his cat and obviously a passing mouse. And clearly he manages to make his whole cosmic vision brought to bear on the cat and the mouse. Extraordinary.
And am I right in thinking that Christopher Smart's poems were lost for many years and they found him in a drawer?
Well, this one was. Mm. I mean, he was known as a sort of minor poet, but Rejoice in the Lamb wasn't made public until it was found in a library in Suffolk, where it had been passed down through the generations. And the editor, William Forstead, published an edition of it in 1939. So when Britain set this in 1943, it was cutting-edge stuff. It may be 18th century, but it was brand new.
And was reading and discovering poetry something that Britain and Arden did together?
I think so, yes.
Now, Sam, I know you narrated Nightmare at the Proms a few years ago. Did that give you an insight into how Britain and Auden's collaboration worked?
The thing that's frustrating about performing Nightmare live, because obviously it's a narration of a GPO film about the train that carries mail to Scotland, is that the central portion, which begins letters of thanks, letters from banks, letters of joy from the girl and the boy, receipted bills and invitations, etc., is so long that you can't actually breathe. The piece is, strictly speaking, unperformable. And I've done it live 5 times now, and I've only got that entry right 3 times. So I think probably it was a work at the early end of Britain and Auden's collaboration, and they perhaps got better at the mechanical aspects of setting words like that. But yes, there's obviously a great joy of discovery that Britain has in poets like Smart that I imagine he and Auden found together. And the enthusiasm with which he selects and the enthusiasm with which he anthologizes is extremely unusual for a composer, I think. He obviously gets a sense that he has a right to do this from his mate.
Now, another element of their relationship involved Auden educating Britain about politics. And while Auden was writing what some called propaganda, Britain's approach was more indirect. Britain chose Wilfred Owen's The Kind Ghosts to set as part of Nocturne in 1958. So let's hear that, Malcolm.
She sleeps on soft last breaths, but no ghost looms out of the stillness of her palace wall, her wall of boys on boys and dooms on dooms. She dreams of golden gardens and sweet glooms, not marveling why her roses never fall, nor what red mouths were torn to make their blooms. The shades keep down which well might roam her hall. Quiet their blood lies in her crimson rooms, and she is not afraid of their footfall. They move not from her tapestries, their pall, nor pace her terraces, their hecatombs, lest aught she be disturbed or grieved at all.
That's a less known poem of Owen's, isn't it? And I wonder what made you choose that one?
Well, I think the War Requiem Owen poems have become quite familiar to us, but I wanted to choose this, which Britain set as part of Nocturne, because it's not explicitly a poem from the trenches. Mm. And it says something to me about the indirections of Britain's methods. Here's a poem which is about not haunting, but is, of course, one of the most haunted of poems. Here's a poem in which the nation is a succulent, sensuous woman envisaged as a kind of sleeping Britannia. And there's a way in which this is a poem about nationhood, about patriotism, and yet it's also so intimate, so private, so sensual, erotic. It brings together, for me, Britain's combination of the bareness, the horror, the bodies piled upon bodies, but also the lushness, the decadent part of Britain, which I think is there all through his career. You know, he remains in love with Keats, for example, and there's a Keatsian element in this.
Some,
yeah, I think, I mean, I'm a member of the Wilfred Owen Society, and I think that Keatsian richness coupled with a barely suppressed fury. I think this poem is more angry than you do. I think that the futility of people dying in order to keep these women or this woman, you know, happy at home, blind to the realities of the front, is barely controlled. In fact, the last line, "Lest aught she be disturbed or grieved at all," reminded me of the last line of futility, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all. You know, this powerful rhetorical question which just goes into air. But there is a kind of Keatsian richness about it. In fact, the next poem in the anthology, in Nocturne, is Sleep and Poetry by John Keats. And that's, I think, what makes him... It's a step forward from the early 30s pacifism, which is sometimes quite strident and banner-waving. And I think a step forward from the sort of flirtations with communism that saw him setting things like Night Mail and dedicating them to the men of the LMS.
It's now time for a few questions from the audience, thinking of things that sit inside the skull. Gentlemen, right at the back.
Would like the panellists to comment on tonight's setting, because we've talked about settings of English poetry, but not about Britain's settings of French. Now, I'm conversant with French, and French, native French speakers don't seem, although they love music, to be very satisfied with Britain's settings of Rimbaud, for example. So could I have some comments? We have some comments about that.
We were discussing what Britain might have seen in Rimbaud before we came on, and Malcolm said simply, "Sexy." I wonder if he turned towards French poetry rather like hipsters turned towards French cinema in the 1950s, you know, got you into better parties. I think possibly it expressed something about his own, as yet fully, not fully understood sexuality.
Yes, because I think when he did set the Michelangelo sonnets in obviously in Italian, I mean, that has a whole gay subtext, well, not really subtext. And I think it was a way of expressing those feelings that could not perhaps be expressed otherwise. I mean, there's that line in Les Illuminations, le double sexe. And it's all... I mean, when I heard it for the first time, I thought it was sexy, actually.
Now, Britain left England for America in 1939, and while he was there, he discovered the work of our next poet, George Crabbe. Here's Marsh Flowers from Five Flower Songs.
Here the strong mallow strikes her slimy root. Here the dull nightshade hangs her deadly fruit. On hills of dust the henbane's faded green and pencilled flower of sickly scent is seen. Here on its wiry stem in rigid bloom grows a salt lavender that lacks perfume. At the wall's base the fiery nettle springs with fruit globose and fierce with poison stings. In every chink delights the fern to grow, with glossy leaf and tawny bloom below. The few dull flowers that all the place are spread partake the nature of their fenny bed. These, with our seaweeds rolling up and down, form the contracted flora of our town.
So, Alexander, we've mentioned that Crabbe was one of these kind of peripheral poets, if you like, that Britain discovered. And what was the impact, do you think, of the discovery of Crabbe?
Wow, the impact. Isn't that the best trip to the florist shop ever? I just love it. I mean, that was set as one of five flower poems. And it's Britain's sort of bouquet. It's a wedding anniversary present. And what you would expect in a wedding bouquet would be, you know, daffodils and tulips. And you get a few of those, and then you get the slimy weeds. And Britain clearly is very much drawn to this alternative pastoral, this vision of a place which is grim and bleak and real. And that's what struck him when he read E.M. Forster's article in the Listener magazine in 1941 about George Crabbe. Piers and Britain were at this point in Escondido, California, having a pretty grim sort of summer, not enjoying themselves. And then they read Forster on George Crabbe, and they read Forster's kind of ode to a poet who has a different sense of beauty, who goes to a place which is bleak and portrays its characters with absolute authenticity and steely nerve. And Forster talks about Crabbe as really belonging to Aldborough, and through Aldborough belonging to Britain. And Britain felt that he realised in that moment what he was lacking, what he had to go back to. So he went back to the slimy weeds.
But he had this tendency as well to anthologise poets when he set them, sometimes combining lines from different poems by the same poet. Why did he do that, do you think?
Yeah, it's a very audacious thing to do, isn't it? And he would, he would just put a pencil mark straight through parts of Shakespeare. He'd rewrite the Bible. Yeah. That was no trouble at all. There's clearly a sense of the work of art, the music, having its own integrity, and so it's absolutely his right to make something new. And it's part of his homage to the power of the original poem, that it is flexible enough to change, that it's something that lives. I think he really does see these things as living verses that want to be transfigured in the present, that want to be made new.
Sammy did the same with Owen, didn't he?
Yes, he did. In War Requiem, yes, he cuts a big wodge of Strange Meeting, which is a fairly famous poem, and also changes a couplet, which is quite complex in the original. Well, in fact, he turns it into two lines. Even with truths that lie too deep for taint, I would have poured my spirit without stint, but not through wounds, not on the cess of war. Foreheads of men have bled where no wounds were, which is quite a complex passage, and he replaces that with, even from wells we sunk too deep for war, even the sweetest wells that ever were, which has got a lot of vowels in it, is much easier to understand. So, in fact, we know from his workbooks that Owen had great problems with that bit. So I think the answer to your question, why did he do it, is because he could.
Now, Aldborough was Britain's home till he died there in 1976. And our final poem takes on the idea of home. It's by Thomas Hardy, and it's The Little Old Table from Winter Words.
Creak. Little wood thing, creak, when I touch you with elbow or knee. That is the way you speak of one who gave you to me. You, little table she brought me with her own hand, as she looked at me with a thought that I did not understand. Whoever owns it anon and hears it, we'll never know what a history hangs upon this creek from long ago.
So, Alexander, what do you think that poem tells us about Britain's choice, Britain's sense of home, if you like?
I think it takes us back to his spareness and bareness and his sense of Hardy controlling all that sprawling, complex emotion and pushing it towards this one wooden table which just won't creak enough, won't creak eloquently enough. And Britain allows Hardy, in a way, that voice. He lets the tenor voice turn into that creaking table.
And Malcolm, as somebody who's played him, did you get the sense that he felt at home in the idea of words and the place of words and music side by side?
Yes, I mean, I think when you listen to him speak, he speaks in a rather old-fashioned way to us, of course, but he's incredibly articulate. He's someone who read all the time and was used to speaking, and you listen to him rehearsing orchestras and choirs, unbelievably articulate and very decisive.
Thank you very much to Samuel West, Alexandra Harris and Malcolm Sinclair. Benjamin Britten's Poets, a collection of all the work he set to music, is out now from Carcanet Press. Goodbye.
And that was Ian McMillan with today's Proms Plus literary event, which happened across the road at the Royal College of Music earlier on today, and it was produced by Ellie Bury. And if your interest in Britain is spiked by that, there's more Britain at the Proms over the coming weeks. On Saturday, lots of his music in the Proms Saturday matinee at 3 o'clock. And then, of course, Billy Budd from Glyndebourne on Tuesday the 27th next week. That's prom number 60. You can find out full details of the proms on the BBC Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. And everyone is, of course, live here on BBC Radio 3, where we're back now at the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, given by the London Symphony Orchestra and their principal guest conductor, Daniel Harding. This concert being given in memory of Sir Colin Davis, such a long and close association with the London Symphony Orchestra, who died in April. We've already heard music by Tippett, his concerto for double string orchestra, and Ian Bostridge singing Britain's Les Illuminations. If you missed those two performances, you can catch them online for 7 days or in the radio repeat on Monday at 2 o'clock. Now, just one work in the second part of this concert, Elgar's Second Symphony, which he wrote over 2 years around 1910, a piece that had really big personal significance for him. He said in a letter to his muse, Alice, that he had written his soul into this symphony. It lasts nearly an hour. It begins with incredible briskness and ebullience and ends in quite a poignant way. During the writing of the symphony, King Edward VII died, and it was in his memory that Elgar dedicated his second symphony. Right at the top of the score of his second symphony, Elgar quotes Shelley, "Rarely, rarely comest thou, spirit of delight." The spirit of delight currently making his way on stage is Carmine Lowry, the leader of the London Symphony Orchestra tonight, taking applause here at a completely packed Royal Albert Hall. And the second spirit of delight following close behind him, conductor Daniel Harding. Sit back and enjoy Elgar's Second Symphony, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra live here at the BBC Proms.
Thank you.
Rarely, rarely comest thou, spirit of delight. A Shelley quote at the very top of Elgar's Second Symphony, performed live here at the BBC Proms by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by their principal guest conductor, Daniel Harding. Not entirely clear whether Elgar meant that this symphony was one of those rare moments when the spirit of delight was present, or whether it was a lament for the fact that it so rarely is. You can make your own mind up. I was reminded listening to that of the words we heard of Ian Bostridge at the very beginning of this concert, paying tribute to the conducting technique of Sir Colin Davis, in whose memory this prom concert has been given tonight, saying he stirred golden syrup with his baton, and there were lashings of golden syrup in that Elgar II interpretation from the LSO and Daniel Harding. Here he comes on stage again. Not only principal guest with the LSO, also the music director of Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra, conductor laureate of the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, whom he was music director for 8 years, and he appeared with them already this season here at the Proms at the end of July with Paul Lewis, who played a Mozart piano concerto with them. And incidentally, there's a complete score of all the piano concertos from this year's Proms online. You can listen to them for up to 30 days, longer than usual. You can find that all on the Proms website. Also on that website, you can do a composer search for Elgar and find out what's more of his to come in this season, stretching from tomorrow all the way until, of course, the last night of the Proms, the all-important Pomp and Circumstance March number one, rounding off the season. Well, do join me for breakfast tomorrow morning on BBC Radio 3 from 6.30 until 9. Among other things, I'm going to be celebrating Dame Janet Baker's 80th birthday with her iconic recording of Elgar's Sea Pictures. I hope you can join me for that. As the applause continues here at the Royal Albert Hall, I'll hand you on to Broadcasting House and Jonathan Swain.
Sarah, thank you very much. Sarah Moore-Peach there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom here on BBC Radio 3 next Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every prom is available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. Well, tomorrow night at the Proms, more Elgar, his Enigma Variations, along with the Sibelius Violin Concerto with violinist Lisa Batiashvili, and the world premiere of Cave of the Luminous Mind by Param Veer, a piece inspired by the mindfulness of Tibetan Buddhism and dedicated to Jonathan Harvey. Zachary Oramo conducts the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and that's live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3 at 7:30 tomorrow night. Well, in 2 or 3 minutes tonight, Proms Plus Late from the Elgar Room of the Royal Albert Hall. Georgia Mann introduces session mixing music by Thomas Brangwen and Friends with poetry by Kayo Chingonyi. For the moment, briefly back to Elgar himself. What if you saw John Bridcut's film on Elgar, The Man Behind the Mask? Memorable for lots of reasons, one of them a chance to hear that strangest of Elgar part songs called Owls, an epitaph. The various contributors to the film, Sir Mark Elder among them, were in a state of wonder that Elgar could have composed it at all. It's the last of the songs that make up Elgar's Opus 53, four songs altogether from 1907 and 8, the same years as he was working on his first symphony. That eerie masterpiece, Owls, is the last of the songs, and its words are by Elgar himself. Paul Spicer conducts the Finzi Singers. Heaven knows what gave rise to that. Owls, ending those Elgar songs, Opus 53. And we heard Owls on its own there. Paul Spicer conducting the Finzi Singers.
This summer, dip in to the BBC Proms. Celebrate the golden age of the movies with John Wilson and his orchestra as they bring their signature style to some of Hollywood's greatest and most recognised themes. The BBC Proms, alive with music. The Hollywood Rhapsody Prom, Monday night at 7:30, live on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, and now we go back to the Royal Albert Hall to hear highlights of a Proms Plus late event recorded last Thursday in the Elgar Room. It's presented by Georgia Mann.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Late, which has a distinctly Eastern musical flavour. Glowing under the Elgar Room's purple-tinged lights are some beautiful Iranian instruments. A santur, which is an Iranian dulcimer, which will be played to us tonight by Thomas Brangwyn. A tonbak and an udu, percussion instruments, which Mehdi Ganjvar will be playing for us. And Adib Rasami will be playing the kemenche, which is the Iranian upright fiddle. Now, Thomas, who really put the band together for us tonight, first came across the santur at a chance encounter at a travelling circus, as he puts it, which I think is kind of brilliant. And he felt so in love with the instrument that he decided to master it come what may, never mind the fact that he didn't have a teacher, didn't know anybody who played it, and indeed didn't know where to find said santur. He managed to kind of overcome all those small details and become a real integral part of the thriving Iranian musical scene, and that's where he met Mehdi and Adib. And tonight they'll be playing for us traditional Persian music, but also some more contemporary stuff. And I know that there has even been some dulcimer dubstep from you before, Thomas, so look out for that. Providing the verse to accompany tonight's shimmering Persian soundtrack is a man whose poetry has been described as wonderfully searching and always compelling. Kayo Chingonye has read his work everywhere from the Big Chill Festival to Tate Modern. He represented Zambia, where he was born and spent the first 6 years of his life, at the South Bank Centre's Poetry Parnassus. And when he's not versifying, he's a hip-hop musician, creative writing teacher, and an events producer for the likes of Comic Relief and British Council. He is a busy man. Kayo will be reading for us very soon. But first, music from Thomas Brangwyn, Mehdi Ganjvar, and Adib Rasami.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you. That was Pishtamarad Homayun and Chahar Mezrab Homayun. Thomas, can I ask you to uncross your legs and come and talk to me, please, or else I might plunge into your dulcimer face first with this microphone. Tell me a bit about this instrument, because you fell so in love with this at the travelling circus that you embarked on this crusade to master it, which I love the story of. But it's quite a small instrument. It's harp-like. It's a wooden soundboard, taut wires, rests flat like that. But it's got these tiny little sticks, which actually, of course, aren't called sticks. It's a big noise coming from the small delicacy. I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of tension. I've heard some people say over a ton of tension. And each note has four strings. And these sticks you grasp very tightly, and it all comes from the wrist, and it's a lot of power here that goes into it. The thing I like about this instrument in particular is it can be found in almost every culture of the world, actually. So I've played traditional English folk music and Hungarian and Romani Eastern European music on a cymbalum, which is a larger version, in most of Asia.
So culturally, it crops up everywhere.
Yeah, I think the Iranians, they are known as the creators, almost, of this instrument thousands of years ago, and it's travelled with civilizations all over the world, and almost everyone has taken hold of it and adapted it to their local musical traditions, yeah.
And now we have it here at the Proms. Thank you, Thomas. I'll let you sit back down. Time now, though, to hear from Kayo Chingonyi.
I thought I'd begin with some musical poems, and this first one, it might resonate with those of you who used to tape songs from the radio. It's called Guide to Proper Mixtape Assembly. The silence between songs cannot be modulated by anything other than held breath. You have to sit and wait. Time the release of the pause button to the last tenth of a second, so that the gap between each track is a smooth purr, a TDK or Memorex, your masterwork. Don't talk to me about your MP3 player. How, given the limitless choice, you hardly ever listen to one song for more than 2 minutes at a time. Do you know about stealing double A's from the TV remote so you can listen to last night's clandestine effort on the walk to school? You say you love music. Have you suffered the loss of a cassette so gnarled by a tape deck's teeth? It refuses to play the beat you've come to recognize by sound and not name. Have you carried that theme in your head all these years, in the faint hope you might know it when it finds you in a far-flung cafe as you stand to pay, frozen, and the barista has to ask if you're okay. This is called Some Bright Elegance, and it's for anyone who likes to go out dancing. For the screw-faced, in good shoes that paper the walls of dance halls, I have little patience. I say dance. Not to be seen but free, your feet are made for better things. Feel the bitterness in you lift as it did for a six-year-old Bojangles, tapping a living out of Richmond beer gardens to the delight of a crowd that wasn't lynching today, but laughing at the quickness of the kid. Throw yourself into the thick, emerging pure, reduced to flesh and bone, nerve and sinew. Your folded arms understand music. Imagine a packed Savoy ballroom and slide across the dusty floor as your zoot-suited 20s self. The feather in your hat from an ostrich, the swagger in your step from the ochre dust of a West African village. Dance for the times you've been stalked by store detectives. For a lady on a bus, for the look of disgust on the face of a boy too young to understand why he hates. Only that he must. Dance for Sammy, dead and penniless, and for the thousands still scraping a buck as street corner hoofers, who, though they dance for their food, move as if it is just them, and the drums talking. This is a poem called March 30th and imagines the day of a funeral. That day, in the same month I was born, your people milled around keening in Luvali for the lofty man, Long John, the room of his chest. So many had been lifted and held to its deafening metrical foot, we'd begun to think it could never stop. We'd begun to think it could never stop. So many had been lifted and held to its deafening metrical foot. For the lofty man, Long John, the room of his chest, your people milled around, keening in Luvali. That day, in the same month, I was born. So I've always been fascinated by those people who used to write into newspapers, you know, the missed connection column in a newspaper. So in an effort to try and understand the kind of person who not so much strikes while the iron is hot, so much as strikes while the iron is broken beyond repair, I wrote this poem. You come into your own at train stations, after the fact, in the safe distance afforded those who remain behind. Stalled beside the point of action, brave enough to speak when the chances of failure and success recede. I was the man in houndstooth shoes you sat next to on the Overground to Richmond at 2:05 on June 22nd. You wore a sundress and Ray-Bans, rims the shade of your lipstick. Drink? So many pages given over to this yen we have for laying ourselves open. So long as it won't end in brokenness. What we have to say of hope hinges within the particular details. Flight 551 from Mexico, seat 18C, the tallest of the Polish contingent. A palpable frisson in the queue at baggage claim. You know an unbidden compliment for what it is. You can be distinguished from your opportunist counterparts by your tendency to qualify. Where brasher paramours, drunk naturally, might blurt, you opt for poise. Since what works in a film tends to fall flat in print, I don't usually do this, but I was afraid you'd live your life not knowing what I'd give to know your name.